online now. I have there, historian in residence, of course, Cormac Moore. Hello, Cormac. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Noel. How are you?
Good, good. Yeah, we're going to talk about the second part of the Anglo-Irish Treaty that in 1921. How long did it go on for? Can I ask you that first?
Yeah, of course. So it started this week, 100 years ago, on the 11th of October, and the treaty was signed at the early hours of the morning of 6th of December. So you're talking, you know, guts of 7-8 weeks it went on for.
Wow.
Yeah.
And all
very intense. Very intense. If you look at them, so they were held in London, mainly in Downing Street, but in other buildings around London, all of the talks. So it was very easy for the British negotiators to, first of all, they could sleep in their own beds at night. They knew the surroundings. It was all a very comfortable environment for them. Whereas the Irish delegation obviously were staying in hotels and the likes, but they had to go back and forth to Dublin, which is a very long journey back then. You know, get trained from Houston to Holyhead and to then back to Dublin. They'd often have cabinet meetings in Dublin and then straight back again to London. So that was an immediate advantage for the British over the Irish from the start.
It's always easy when you're negotiating with someone who's tired, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, and that is that was very crucial. If we look at that early morning, the 6th of December, there was a cabinet meeting in Dublin, a very fractious cabinet meeting in Dublin that weekend, just days beforehand. Collins, when he was going over to Dublin for the cabinet meeting, there was an accident on the boat, and people actually got killed. He didn't get injured, but it must have been very traumatic. They had to go back to Holyhead and then go back again to Dublin. So all this is happening. They were all very tired, and that definitely would have helped the British side.
Okay, and what was the balance like in the talks of the people, Irish, English, numbers at the contingency?
Well, the Irish had five actual plenipotentiaries. So Arthur Griffith led them, and then Michael Collins was the de facto number two, and then you had Charles Gavan Duffy, you had Eamon Duggan, and you had Robert Barton. And then you had a team of secretaries and advisors as well from the Irish side. Mm-hmm. And then on the British side, you had heavy hitters, really international, negotiators used to international treaties and rigid debate in the House of Commons or House of Lords. So led by Lloyd George, who was the big beast, as Lord Beaverbrook called him. He was the one who really ran the show. And was a masterful negotiator, really slippery character. You know, was very, 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 very smart, very capable. He led the negotiation team. Then you had Birkenhead. You had Winston Churchill. You had the War Secretary Worthington Evans. You had the Attorney General Hewart, and you had Hammer Greenwood. He was the Chief Secretary for Ireland. And then you had the temporary leader of the Conservative Party, who were in coalition with Lloyd George, Austin Chamberlain. He was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So the British were very experienced negotiators, and they were up against the Irish. The Irish didn't have much experience. Like if we look at their experience, both of them were on their own. There had been very few Dáil meetings since the first one of January 1919, and the Dáil was essentially a talking shop because it was just Sinn Féin, TDs. There was no opposition. So they didn't have that kind of exposure and experience that the British had.
Yeah, because the British had been doing talks on Canada and Australia and things like that to precede all of this.
Yeah, they had regular meetings with the Dominions. You know, they had at that time, particularly at the time of the truce, there was a Dominion conference happening. They were very used to negotiating and dealing with international affairs. They were heavily involved, obviously, in the Treaty of Versailles and the other treaties that brought an end to the First World War. They were involved in other partitions that were happening at the time around Europe and elsewhere. So they had a whole kind of portfolio of negotiations behind them.
Mm-hmm. And when you say like there was negotiations and partitions, does any of those partitions exist in any other countries that you could point out that sort of would be on comparison with ours, as it ended up?
There actually was a lot of partitions that happened at the end of the First World War. And you had Upper Silesia, then you had Hungary, you had different areas in Hungary. You had between Denmark and Germany, you had partitions. So there's about four or five major ones in Europe at the time. All of them had a boundary commission as well. But the boundary commission had a plebiscite, which decided, people got to decide which country they wanted to be in. Whereas, as we'll talk about later down the track, that wasn't offered with the Irish boundary commission.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what were the most contentious points? If they're, I mean, I'm sure they were all that way, but that would stick out.
Well, there were two. There was about five areas discussed, like defence, kind of trade, finance, the two big ones by far, the most contentious, were the Crown and Ulster. Some historians, and it's constantly mentioned that Ulster wasn't important. The Irish delegates were only interested in the Crown. That just isn't true. You know, they spent so much time and effort on partition. So, you know, for our listeners, we have to remember that Northern Ireland was in place by the time the treaty started. There was a Northern Ireland. You know, mm-hmm. it came into being in the summer of 1921. So it existed. But even though it existed, it still was on the table, you know, much to the disappointment of Ulster Unionists. Sinn Féin were successful in reopening and rekindling the Ulster question. And they spent, I was actually going through a lot of the files yesterday of the negotiations. And the Sinn Féin delegates spent a huge amount of time on pressuring the British government on Ulster and really, really sought and definitely wanted an essential unity of Ireland. So it's definitely not correct to say that Sinn Féin didn't care about partition mm-hmm. or Ulster. They spent a lot of time on it, but they did blunder in agreeing to such a vague, indefinable boundary commission clause, which essentially led to the status quo remaining in 1925. But they did care about Ulster. It is important to point that out. Yeah. So Ulster and the Crown were the two most important issues. Now, Sinn Féin, if the negotiations were going to break, Sinn Féin wanted them to break on Ulster because the British government had a very weak moral case on Ulster, as they recognised themselves. And it came down to the fact that you had six counties imposed with the partition, but two of those, Tyrone and Fermanagh in particular, had majority Catholic population. So they were forced into this settlement that they didn't even have a vote, a say on, and the British realised that that they didn't have a strong case when it came to Ulster, and mm-hmm. and Sinn Féin knew that as well. So if it was going to be a break, it should be on Ulster, yeah. Where the British wanted it to break, if it was going to break, on the Crown and sovereignty. So mm-hmm. on.
Yeah, because I mean, would it be correct to say, for instance, like the way you're talking about, people think that the six counties came into force just after this agreement, but where it was always subliminally there, in people's minds, there was always a border there, even if it's only subliminal, not a hard border, but it was always sort of there.
And I think that has been overstated as well. Like, yes, of course, there was. If you go to the northeast of Ulster, there was obviously a huge amount of people that wanted to remain with Britain. But there was only two counties of what became the six counties that had substantial Protestant majorities, Antrim and Down. Derry City was a significant majority Catholic city. Derry County was majority Protestant overall, Derry, mm-hmm. but not a huge majority. Same at Armagh. And Tyrone and Fermanagh had Catholic majority, so they wanted to be retained in Ireland. So it is not right to say that the six counties were subliminally partitioned beforehand. And even if you go outside of Belfast and its surrounding environs, there wasn't that much difference between, the northeast of Ulster and the rest of Ireland. It was kind of around the industrial belt of Belfast and the surrounding areas where the real kind of opposition to home rule and Irish independence came from.
Mm-hmm. And there's always, as we've seen recently, there's always a little bit of hoo-ha. But every time this comes around, maybe. I don't know, I wouldn't say it's annually, but maybe a significant time, like it is 100 years now, but maybe when it's 10 years, 20, 30, stuff like that, there's always a kick-up to an extent, isn't there?
In terms of partition?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, obviously, it's front and centre now because of obviously 100, aside from 100 years, but then you talk about Brexit has brought it back to the fore with a bang, and the fact that the demographics have changed significantly as well. You know, when Northern Ireland was created, it was created to have a two-thirds majority, you know, a permanent majority for Ulster Unionists, and that's gone now. You know, they don't have a majority anymore, and there will be a border poll. I'm not sure when, but it will happen. So it's going to be in the news for a long time to come.
Yeah, because we're still in Europe as well, and as you say, Brexit, like, that's going to be a big contentious point as well. And who wants? It won't be just a case of an Ireland. It'll be a case of who wants to stay in Europe and who doesn't as well. So that's going to be thrown into the mix, isn't it?
Yeah, that'll be up for debate. But I think most people in Northern Ireland, as was shown with the Brexit vote, wanted to remain in Europe. So that's I know it goes along the lines in some ways, between kind of unionist nationalists. But the majority of people in Northern Ireland, by about 55-56%. Wanted to remain in Europe. I would say if you had a vote today, it would be even higher at that stage.
Well, that's remain. Like, if it come up about United Ireland, that would come into the mix, and it might sway people to vote for United Ireland because they'd want to get back into Europe. If they were on
absolutely,
the fence,
yeah.
If
yeah,
they're on the fence right. Before, that's something that would sway them, isn't it?
Yeah, no. And I've said it before as well. Like the circumstances of unionists not wanting to be part of an independent Ireland, they've changed. You know, they claim that home rule would be Rome rule, that the rest of Ireland was impoverished compared to themselves. And obviously Britain was at the time was the world's biggest empire. You know, had a lot of wealth and prestige to it. You know, that's pretty much all gone. All those arguments are gone now.
And, certainly are. Yeah.
So yeah, it's obviously very different circumstances to what it was 100 years ago.
Okay, listen, it's been great. And will you be continuing with this? Are you on next week as well, Cormac?
No, it'll be in the next few weeks. I'll be around, yeah.
Okay.
We've loads of time to talk about the treaty. It's still a good few weeks to go. Okay.
No,
it's just 100th anniversary of time.
Yeah, it's just I'll be missing myself another week next week. We'll be back this day fortnight. So I look forward to talking to you then and continuing on this as well. Any lectures coming up, Cormac, for yourself?
Yeah, well, there'll be a few now coming up on the treaty, more early December, so there'll be plenty of time we can talk about them. But yeah, around the time of the 100th anniversary of the signing.
Okay, I'm sure a lot of people, they love you on the radio, so I'm sure when they come up, they'll be looking forward to going to see that as well. Thanks very much, Cormac. Talk to you in a fortnight
or so.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
All the best. Bye.
And that's our historian in residence, Cormac Moore. It's always great. I love having Cormac on, and judging by our listeners, they do as well.